This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on Talk Louisiana, we'll visit with Louis Wren, president of the AFL-CIO Louisiana for the last 13 years. Louis will comment on labor in Louisiana, including the legislature's reluctance to pass bills for equal pay and for a minimum wage increase. Also, we are slated to hear from Julie Stokes, state representative running for Secretary of State. She'll have the latest on not only her campaign, but the prognosis for the special session, which began yesterday. And Jessica Houghton Wilson, her book is about Louisiana writer Walker Percy, the man who gave us The Moviegoer and some other fine works. The book is Reading Walker Percy's Novels, from Jessica Houghton Wilson, about the writer who died 28 years ago this month. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Your numbers, as always, locally in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. If you're on the road or out and about or somewhere else in our state, or anywhere else for that matter, 877-217-5757 is your number. And you can always send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. In a moment, we're going to hear from Louis Wren, the longtime head of the AFL-CIO in Louisiana. We start with State Representative Julie Stokes, who is en route to the Capitol as we speak for another special session. And Julie Stokes is also a candidate for Secretary of State. And before we get there, what about the special session? This is the sixth one, I think, in the 2.5 years of Governor John Bel Edwards. Your prognosis, Julie Stokes?
Gosh, I wish I could say that I truly believe that we're going to be able to come together. I mean, I definitely believe that we could fix this. You put a couple of us in a room together, and in 20 minutes we could walk out with a solution. But I'm concerned with what I'm calling the expectation gap. I think that Republicans have an expectation that they're going to be able to solve this with a quarter of a penny and a few things. And Democrats, and especially Democrats, don't believe that. They really don't prefer to do a sales tax in the first place. So if that sales tax doesn't fully fund the deficit, like a quarter of a penny would not, then they're not going to be in favor of that. And they've been telling, both sides have been telling all their constituents all of this kind of stuff for months. So how do you get the votes to come together when everybody's been saying very disparate stuff in their communities?
Now, are lawmakers haggling over the difference between a quarter penny and a half penny?
Right now, I don't hear a lot of it, but I'm friends with a lot of people on both sides, and I hear it swelling. And I'm sure they realize it, but uh-huh. I think that that's going to be a lot of the battle.
And it's a heavy lift because it takes 70 votes, not a majority, but a two-thirds majority, supermajority. Can 70 votes be attained?
I'll tell you, I'm not sure, but I would tell you that I pray every day that we can get this right, because I'm so tired of going to special session. I know that our voters and our constituents, the great people of Louisiana, are tired of hearing it. I'm tired of our name being dragged through the mud nationally. Let's just come together, accept one common truth about where our state is right now, and fix our mess and move on.
What do you find palatable? Would you be capable of voting for a half penny increase? Depending on your point of view, it's either an increase or a decrease, but would a half penny be acceptable to you?
Actually, you know, what I hear in there is that we had over $1 billion of taxes rolling off. We decided that the financial future, the price of oil, things like that, were looking a little better. So we could knock, some money off of that 1.2 or whatever, wherever we were. Then, you know, you had the federal tax reform, which was going to bring in another $300 million. You know, you've had a few savings that have been, you know, talked about. I think you could easily solve it once and for all with a half a penny and maybe some piddling of little other things. I have a feeling that it's going to be hard to move a lot of people off of wanting the quarter of a penny, because they've been talking about it for a while. But in essence, it doesn't solve our problem. Just like when we did a 27 month sales tax penny. And now the end of that 27 months has come, and not a lot has changed. We're still in a mess. We couldn't solve our problem back then. We elected not to solve our problem back then, and we're doing it again. If we don't, probably, I don't see any other solution, probably, than doing the half a penny. But I'm encouraged to hear anything that anybody has to offer.
Who's to blame for where we are?
You know, I think it's politics. I don't think any one person is to blame. I think it's that our politics, I think both statewide and nationally, everywhere, has devolved into being, and we're no longer debating just left-right issues. We're not debating whether we want a flat tax, which I was a big proponent of, or if we want a sharply progressive tax. We're debating two different versions of reality. Are we broke, or are we really just have more money than we need and wasting your money? And until the political divide stops being two versions of reality, then you can't solve your problems. Because, you know, in a marriage, if you and your wife can't agree over what you're fighting about, can you solve your problem? No. Huh. And that's the same problem I think we face right now.
Well, you have let it be known that you'd like another job, as in this year. There's an election this fall to have a replacement, at least for a while, for a year, for Tom Shedler, the Secretary of State who resigned. Why did you decide to go this route, Representative Stokes?
You know, I feel like within the House, I've often been somebody who's willing to work between the sides of the aisle, you know, work with both sides, and try to be a voice of truth out there, reconciling these two different versions of reality that you hear about. So I think to be able to have a statewide position to help to reconcile the truth for people is one thing. Another thing is that I think that because the Secretary of State holds a corporate database, that it's an excellent opportunity to make Louisiana, registering your business in Louisiana in every parish, because we have a complicated system, to be done through one portal, to be done in the most effortless possible way, in a way that encourages people to want to come here, to live here, to bring their kids here. And I think one way to do that is say, okay, you've now incorporated. What next? What parish are you going to be in? And then route them electronically to that parish. You know, are you going to have employees? If so, you route them to the state unemployment or the workforce commission. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of things that could be done like that. Also, I'm a details girl. I'm a very organized details person. Although I can see the big picture, what I think is also a great opportunity is to keep people's data very secure, to hire some of the best data security people to make sure that the vast amount of data that we have is kept safe, and also that our elections are kept safe. You know, we face a lot of things in this country right now with hacking. It's just getting to be so prevalent that something like this happens, that our voting systems have to be of the highest integrity, and the way that we manage people's data and hold it securely away from others is very important, and something that I think I can bring to.
Now, many thought you would have won the treasurer's race a year ago, and you at one point were a candidate. What happened? What's changed in the last year to make you palatable as far as running for a statewide office?
Well, you know, honestly, it's very difficult to run against an incumbent. And this office opened up, and the entire time I battled cancer, and I had to give up that treasurer's race. I'll say it was probably, definitely, professionally the most difficult choice I ever had to make to get out of that race. It was very painful. I had to lay off campaign staff. It was just an awful time. And I prayed, God, I know that you're closing this door, that life is closing this door, cancer is closing this door, but Lord, please open up another door, because I'm kind of confused right now, because I really felt so much purpose and call about this. And I do feel that this was that door opening back up. It was a little bit different, and maybe there's a reason out there. I don't
look forward to keeping up with you on the campaign trail and certainly getting your recap of the special session, which now must end by June 4th. We'll see what happens. Julie Stokes, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Jim. Have a good day.
See you soon. Take care. And now we're about to go to a break, but before we get there, we've got Lewis Wren in studio. For 13 years, he's been head of the AFL-CIO in Louisiana, the labor union of renown. How many members are there now in the state of Louisiana, Lewis?
Good morning, Jim. It's a pleasure to be with you again. I would estimate we're probably at somewhere around 130,000 to 140,000 union members within the state.
Still a big number.
Yes. And then actually, we're one of the few states in the country where union membership is actually growing.
Well, you have a vested interest, as does every citizen, in this special session. How important is it for your rank-and-file members?
Oh, I think it's extremely important. You know, whether it's a union issue or, but, you know, when it comes to the future of our children, the availability for education, this talk about kicking people out of nursing homes and not funding hospitals, I think that's going to affect all the citizens of the state of Louisiana.
Lewis Wren's our guest. Your numbers again are 877-217-5757 and 297-5633. You can email us, talk@talklouisiana.org. We'll get Lewis's take on what the legislature did not do in the last session. No increase in minimum wage, and also no equal pay bill. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing. 877-217-5757 is your number. talk@talklouisiana.org is our email. And Lewis Wren is our guest, the head of the AFL-CIO in Louisiana for 13 years. Many remember the legendary Victor Busey. I guess Red Berg was between the two of you.
Also Sybil Holmes.
That's right, Sybil, who was a guest on this show. Very eloquent lady. Was also head of the AFL-CIO for a while. But Lewis is a Baton Rougean, went to Broadmoor High, and grew up down the street from one Billy Cannon.
Yep, a legend passes away.
Yeah, today, 2 o'clock, services at the Pete Maravich Assembly Center for William Ab Billy Cannon, and he was 80 years old when he died on Sunday. The officiant and the eulogist will be our guest of yesterday, Charlie D. Gravel, the biographer of Billy Cannon. And I'm sure thousands will stream into a basketball arena to say goodbye to LSU's greatest football icon, Billy Cannon. We'll talk, things go according to plan, a little more about Billy before we part company today. But Lewis Wren, 13 years head of the AFL-CIO, and I think the minimum wage when you took over was $7.25, and it's still
$7.25. We've looked at that every year in the legislature for at least 20 years that I've been here.
Even in the great state of Arkansas, a red state, a poor state, a southern state, the lawmakers, very conservative legislature, voted a few years ago to make the minimum wage in Arkansas $8.50. Why can't we do it in Louisiana?
Well, I believe the difference in Arkansas, they allowed the people to vote. And we've had several opportunities to put this before the voters, and that has not managed to get out of the legislature. I think both of those issues, you see the influence of lobby in the legislature. I find it amusing that a lot of people who come to testify state that they pay far above the minimum wage, yet they're opposed to it. I think it's just one of those issues that the business community holds sacred and really don't want to let go of. Nobody should go to work all week, 40 hours, and go home and live in poverty. And surely at $7.25, it's not a livable wage. And it's just a tragedy, but we'll keep fighting, and it's the right thing to do.
Well, $7.25 doesn't get you a long way in today's environment. If you work 40 hours at $7.25 a week, you're at $290 a week times 52 weeks. That's $15,080 a year. And for those who don't like public assistance. When the minimum wage is at that level, there sometimes is a lack of motivation for people to go out and find a job, because when you find a job, you have to leave the house. If you've got kids, that's an expense. If you've got to get a babysitter and such, that sometimes the numbers just don't pencil when you pay people that kind of a low rate. But there are those, Lewis Wren, like Lauren Scott, the LSU economist, who believe that we shouldn't have any minimum wage, that the market should just determine everything. Is there some validity to that school of thought, or is Lauren out of his tree?
Well, if you adopt that philosophy, we shouldn't have any regulations, and trust that the business community is going to take care of the environment, do the right thing by their employees. I think to protect the interest of the people, we do need to have some regulations. Otherwise, we've seen in the past what can happen to our environment, what can happen to workers who get injured if there were no workers' comp. Surely we see this problem with misclassification of employees that end up not getting their Social Security paid, who end up having a great problem with the taxation. We did a study one time in Florida that misclassification of employees was costing the state of Florida over $1 billion. If we address that issue, we might could solve the budget deficit without the sales tax.
877-217-5757 for Lewis Wren, president of the AFL-CIO. Patrick on Bluebonnet. Hi, Patrick. You're on with Lewis.
Yeah, Lewis, you say you're for the worker, yet you want to eliminate jobs for teenagers, people just starting out, low skill. When you raise the minimum wage, you make it impossible for employers to hire young people, to hire people starting out, to get the skills that they need to then graduate to higher paying jobs. I started out at McDonald's making minimum wage, okay? I don't think the government should be dictating employers what minimum wage is. Minimum wage should be based on what the free market will pay for that employee, and you're eliminating jobs for teenagers. Teenagers can't get jobs nowadays because the cost to pay for a teenager is so expensive, the company can't afford it.
Thank you, Patrick. Lewis, your response?
Well, Patrick, you may be right. There could be accommodations made. There is a training wage now. There could be a part-time wage. There are issues that could be addressed, but if you're not willing to address the issues and look at it and you're just absolutely against it, then those conversations never happen.
So you're saying that you might be open to a part-time wage and a full-time wage?
I don't know how that would be structured. Right now, it's my understanding there exists what's called a training wage, mm-hmm. That someone could start and maybe not be paid the higher minimum wage to a certain period of time. I have a philosophy that people hire people because they need them. They contribute to the bottom line of the employer. My father was in business. He had three trucks. He hired three truck drivers. He didn't hire them because he wanted to give three people a job. He hired them because he needed three people to deliver his product. That was part of the bottom line that created the profit of the company. You know, that the idea that people give jobs, they don't give jobs. They hire people because they need them to be a productive part of their business.
A listener notes, Holly in the Garden District, that waitresses, for example, they don't make minimum wage. They make, I think it's half of minimum wage, maybe even less than that.
I think it's $2.15.
$2.15. So if they don't get any tips, they're in a world of hurt.
Let me tell you what's amazing. A waitress or waiter who is paid $2.15, when they get their check, are taxed at the $7.25 rate. It is supposedly assumed that they will make the difference in tips. But if they go to the employer and demand what they legally can and said, you know, I didn't get the tips today, then they'll just let them go and say, if you can't make that amount of tips, then, you know, we're not going to pay you the difference in the minimum wage.
Ben on Segan. Hi, Ben. You're on the air with Lewis Wren.
Hey, yeah. The caller who had just said that if you'd raised minimum wage, people weren't going to be hiring. I don't think he's really looked out there to notice that, I mean, tons of places are hiring, especially restaurants and supermarkets. I see signs everywhere they're looking for employees. So I really don't think raising the minimum wage would, you know, stop people from hiring.
If you will look at the places that have adopted a minimum wage, and for years I call this bill the sky is falling, the Chicken Little bill, that, oh, if we raise the minimum wage, then all these people will lose their jobs. In the places where the minimum wage has been raised, there's actually more employment opportunity than less. Those are the statistics. Asking someone to pay at least a minimum amount. I'll tell you the truth, $8.50 is not a livable wage, but it's a step in the right direction. Like I said, I go back to employers don't hire people just to hire them. They hire them because they need them. They're part of the productivity of their business. In asking to be paid at least the minimum wage, I don't think it's unreasonable.
Well, Stephen Wagasback was on this show not so long ago, and he said that businesses, and he's right, they operate on the margins, and anytime you cut into that, you take the risk of killing off a business. But is moving from $7.25 to $8.50 going to be a job killer and a business killer?
I don't think that the statistics show in any city or any state that's raised the minimum wage that it's been a job killer.
877-217-5757. We have more time with Lewis Wren, the president of the AFL-CIO. Should we have an increase in the minimum wage? Lawmakers and their wisdom have said no for several years in a row. We'll talk about it some more after the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana on WRKF. Ali Baltazar is our producer, and our guest for a little while longer is Lewis Wren, president of the AFL-CIO Louisiana for 13 years, and he's been down in the Capitol in the trenches for 21 years. And the last decade or so, he's been involved in trying to get a minimum wage increase, and John Bel Edwards, the governor, has put the full force of the governor's office behind this measure and wants us as a state to get to the Arkansas level of $8.50 an hour. It's $7.25 an hour in Louisiana, one of a few states still at that level. The national level sets our level until further notice. And Lewis Wren, if it went to a vote of the people, do you think it would pass?
Absolutely. Most every place it's gone to a vote of the people, it's passed. I commend the governor. As he traveled the state in talk to the people of the state, and the polls show that the vast majority of the citizens of Louisiana support this issue, and as governor, supporting the people in their wishes, I commend him for that.
877-217-5757 is your number for Lewis Wren, Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Mr. Wren.
Hey, Mr. Wren, is the need for government regulation because if you leave employment decisions up to employers and environmental decisions up to polluters and health care decisions up to providers, then we're left with the new golden rule. Who's got the gold gets to make the rules.
Well, I would tell you that some employers would do the right thing, but there are going to be some bad players in the workplace, and I think those regulations and rules are to protect the citizens and the workers from those people. I'm not going to tell you that every company would pollute, but history has shown without regulations, some would. Not all employers are going to pay the cheapest wage they can, but some would. So, you know, it's like everything in life and the laws the legislature pass. We need to regulate those who would not do the right thing on their own.
Another measure that the governor has been profoundly in favor of without success is this equal pay measure that would ensure at least there would be a legal recourse if a man and a woman were working the same job at the same place and making different wages. There would be an avenue to go to court and see if there is a way to resolve this. Should the state get involved in this kind of a matter?
Absolutely. I mean, it's embarrassing that we're at the biggest difference between men and women in wages who do the same job. Look, I've got five sisters and four granddaughters. I don't have a choice. I have to support it if I'm going to go home. But, if you know, in our collective bargaining agreements, this is not a problem. There's a wage set, and it's to perform a certain duty, and you, if you can do your job, you get paid, and there's no differential. Pat Smith pointed out one time that she had been a victim of the difference in the pay gap until she worked under a collective bargaining agreement, and then she got equal pay. But it's ridiculous that at this day and time that we can't address the issue of if you go to work, you produce the product, you're qualified for the job, you're doing the work, then you should be paid the wage that's appropriate for that job, and it shouldn't matter whether you're a male or a female.
Henry at the Country Club of Louisiana. Henry, good morning. You're on the air with Lewis Wren.
Well, good morning, Mr. Jim. Good morning, Mr. Lewis. How y'all doing today?
We're doing fine. Good morning, Henry.
I got a question, and maybe you're not the person to ask. Maybe Dr. Scott would be more the one to ask this. But we were sold the bill of goods on this right to work, so-called right to work law back in the mid-70s. All these new jobs were going to come, and they weren't going to be quite as high as the union wage, but they were going to be almost. But we were going to have so many jobs it wouldn't matter. Well, not only, and this was touted by LIBE, the organization founded by Mr. Ed Steimel, who was a friend of mine. He's long since passed, but nevertheless, I think he was a good man. I just happened to disagree with him, and you know his kids. We all grew up in Broadmoor, Sherwood Forest together. Even Mr. Ed, as time went on, he saw what the end result of this so-called right-to-work law was, and he wrote a letter to the editor just ripping it to shreds. For the life of me, LIBE, this lobbying company, seems to push and push and push to keep the workers down. I was wondering if maybe we could go back to LIBE and ask them where those jobs are or to give us some type of consolation, because a man can't make it or a woman can't make it. Nobody can make it these days, and poverty is just bringing us all down. You look at the killings we're having in Baton Rouge. Ultimately, the root cause is poverty.
What do you think? Thank you, Henry.
Thank you, Henry. I think you're right. You are correct. Ed Steimel did write a letter to the editor many years ago, realized that all right to work did was hold down the wages artificially within the state. And this is not just a LIBE. This is a nationwide push. I find it amazing. If you will go to LIBE's website, it sounds more like a union organizing pamphlet than I have, about how if you pay dues to an organization and you stick together and work together, your voice is louder. I find it amazing that that's their promotion of their organization. But when it comes to employees who want to do the same thing by joining a union, understanding that together they have better strength, then maybe that's not a good idea. But this is a national push. It's financed by some very wealthy people in the National Right to Work Committee. LIBE just seems to go along with that. I find it amazing. The doctors have a wonderful union. It's called the Medical Association. Attorneys have probably the biggest union in the state of Louisiana, and it's called the Bar Association. And your dues are not or mandatory. If you don't belong to the Bar Association, you can't practice as a lawyer in the state of Louisiana. Nobody is forced to join a union in the state of Louisiana. Nobody's forced to stay in the union. But Right to Work says, as a group of people, we can't have an exclusive agreement with a company. Every other company bargains with the other company, and that's fine. But when it gets down to the employees, there seems to be a problem with that.
Larry Carter, the head of the Louisiana Federation for Teachers, will be with us Monday. And now, this week, there was word that teachers might opt to take some sort of action. They're not happy about their plight. Is it a bad situation for teachers in Louisiana, public school teachers?
Well, I saw the superintendent last night on the news talking about the plight of being able to attract teachers at current pay rate, that the state has not increased the MFP in 10 years. to allow for cost of living increases of teachers. Years ago, I worked with a school-to-work group where we took teachers into the workplace and found out that they were grossly underpaid. With the education level required to be a teacher in the marketplace, they're worth about twice as much as they're getting paid. So if the future of our children is important, then we have to pay what it would take to attract the qualified people to be school teachers, and the current pay is just not there.
What happened during the session, independent of the two items we discussed, minimum wage and equal pay, was it a good session for you or was it a disappointment?
Well, I was discussing yesterday who was the number one winner in the session, regular session, and it was probably Riverboats. They passed a bill that's going to allow them to expand their footprint and actually be land-based. Some of the issues that we did.
Were you supportive of that?
We just watched. Gambling has become
well,
a
it
huge
might,
revenue
it might mean
generator
more jobs.
For the state. There may be some more jobs in building those boats. We'll see where it goes.
Right.
Like I said, the biggest deal is that I think the revenue from gaming has exceeded the revenue to the state from corporate income tax.
Repeat that. The revenue from gaming exceeds
the revenue from
corporate
income
tax.
I think we're at like 8% of the state budget now comes from gaming revenue.
Okay.
One of the big disappointments in that was Harris had offered the state $60 million up front, plus $3.5 million a year that would have gone to funding early childhood education. They were going to take over the payment to the city of New Orleans for the state at $3.5 million. In exchange, they were willing to make a $350 million investment to build a new hotel in New Orleans on top of the casino. That would have been jobs. We're assured that those jobs would have went to New Orleans people and Louisiana citizens. You go to some of these other plants in which we've given huge tax breaks, and you find the parking lots are full of cars from out of state. So we gave up state revenue to create jobs for people who live in another state. This one would have created 600 construction jobs, and the vast majority of those would have gone to Louisiana citizens, and 500 permanent jobs. And Harris already operates a hotel in New Orleans where the pay scale for their employees is probably some of the highest in the hospitality industry in New Orleans. So we were disappointed to see that in the last hours it didn't make it through the session.
What's the stability right now of the AFL-CIO?
We're alive and well. I'm sure there's some people who wish we would go away. That we bring a voice to the process for working men and women. That's part of the problem with the minimum wage. It's really not a union issue. Most of our union, I don't know that any of our union members are working for minimum wage. But when the issues come up, there was an issue that it's mandated by federal law now that certain people have to have background checks. They wanted to say that if an employee left in less than 90 days, they would take that out of their final check. Without us down there, I don't think there would have been a voice to protect those workers from having their pay taken back after they earned it.
Louis Wren, always good to talk with you. We'll be calling again soon. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll return after this quick timeout with more Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, 297-5633 if you're dialing in the Baton Rouge area. Talk@talklouisiana.org is our email address. As noted at the top of the program today, Billy Cannon's funeral is at 2 o'clock. Visitation starts at noon at the Pete Maravich Assembly Center. And Billy Cannon is the greatest football icon in a state that loves football like no other state, and in a university where football often reigns supreme. And in 2010, he was listed number one among the 150 most influential sporting icons in LSU history in a Tiger Rag survey. Pete Maravich was second. And a bit of an irony is that Billy's services are at the Pete Maravich Assembly Center. And Nick Saban was number three, Paul Dietzel four, Dale Brown number five, Skipper Hurd, the former athletic director from 1932 to 55 at LSU, was number six, and Stanley Skip Birdman was number seven on the Tiger Rag list of the 150 most influential LSU sporting people. And Skip Birdman is celebrating birthday number 80 today. Number 80 is the birthday of Stanley Skip Birdman, who led LSU to a national championship in baseball in the year of 1991. And then he did again in 93, in 96, 97, and again, of course, in the year of 2000 is he closed out his career. 1984 to 2001, Skip Birdman was the head baseball coach at Louisiana State University and built a program that now reigns supreme. Annually, it is the top attendance getter in the United States and in all of college baseball by a huge margin. The Tigers are still alive in the SEC tournament, and LSU this year has not played particularly well, but the Tigers are hopeful that they can turn it around in postseason play as they have before under Coach Paul Maneri. And Paul Maneri, of course, led LSU to a national title in 2009. So it has been a while. And right now, we're trying to make contact with Jessica Hooten Wilson, who has a fine book about Walker Percy from LSU Press. And I think Allie Baltazar has been successful in reaching Professor Wilson, who teaches at John Brown University. And her book is Reading Walker Percy's Novels. Walker Percy lived in Covington. That's where he died at the age of 73, 28 years ago. And Jessica, it is amazing that 28 years after his last breath, Walker Percy remains an iconic figure not only in Louisiana but around the world as one of the great novelists of his time. It is a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you for having me on.
What do you attribute his enduring popularity to?
Well, I think he was a prophetic novelist, and the reason I say that is because he wasn't trying necessarily to tell the future, but he was trying to warn us against things that he saw in American culture that might lead to a certain vision of the future. And he was trying to dissuade us from creating that reality 20 to 30 years in the future. Unfortunately, not enough people listened to him. And so the vision that he had, that he shows in his novels of the future, has come to pass. And so 20 to 30 years later, we are living the vision of his apocalypse. And I think people are recognizing that and relating to that in his work.
Well, he was recognized appropriately as a Louisiana author, but he was born in Birmingham and educated at, of all places, the University of North Carolina, B.S. in chemistry, and an M.D. at Columbia University in New York. Not your customary path for a prolific and profound writer like Walker Percy was.
No, not at all. As a young man, he enjoyed novels, and his guardian was Will Percy, who was a famous poet at his time. And so he was always around fiction, always around poetry, but that was not the profession that the Percys went into. Percys went into law, or they became doctors, or they became politicians. They did not become writers. Will Percy was kind of a renegade that way. So Percy, when he first attended North Carolina, assumed he needed to choose between doctor, lawyer, or politician, and he chose doctor.
He burst on the scene 1961 with The Moviegoer, a novel that is synonymous with New Orleans and the Britannia Theater, and you go into his most famous works. What is the magic of The Moviegoer?
Well, I think that it hit a chord when it came out in 1961. There was quite a lot of discussion about the purpose of life. Are we just throwing ourselves into sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and is there anything else out there? And Percy's protagonist, Bing Spoling, he attempts to discover an answer to that question. So you have this young man who is just not satisfied with the life that he's chosen, in which he dallies with secretaries on the weekends and watches movies to pass the time. I think Percy's novel in this way is more prescient now than it was then, because then you had to attend a movie theater and go sit in the dark by yourself and feel that isolation and try to numb yourself out of everydayness. And now you can do it on your phone. I mean, every moment can be an escape from reality. And so I think people really recognize that he was tapping into some alienation that was being experienced by people in America.
I remember reading that book when I was in college at LSU. If I were to reread it, what should I look for the second time around?
I think that it has a strong hint of the past. It fits better in the Western tradition than I think people recognized in 1961. They saw it as something original and contemporary, a new voice. When in reality, you look back and it is Camus, it's Dostoevsky, it's Kierkegaard. There's actually a richer history in the book than what first meets the eye. It reads like a Louisiana 1960s novel until you start digging deeper, and then you realize the universal questions and conversation that Percy's tapping into, and it becomes amazing.
Well, our guest Jessica Houghton Wilson goes into some of the other works of Walker Percy, including Love in the Ruins. This is a book that was 10 years after The Moviegoer, one of the great titles of all time. Love in the Ruins, The Adventures of a Bad Catholic at a Time Near the End of the World. And Percy was often identified as a Catholic writer. He converted to Catholicism. How important was his faith to his work?
It was crucial. When he was a medical student up at Columbia, one of the reasons he switched from being a doctor to being a novelist was because of his Catholic conversion. So he nearly died of tuberculosis. And during a time of quarantine, he spent that time reading great novels and also reading an essay by Kierkegaard called Of the Difference Between an Apostle and a Genius. And this essay influenced Percy's decision to become a Catholic and a novelist, because Kierkegaard says, if an apostle says something, it has an authority to it. If a genius says something, it does not. It could be true, but it doesn't have the authority behind it. And here's Percy thinking, wow, if something has the authority, then you must listen. What's the difference between an apostle and a genius? And can I be a genius or an apostle in my writing? And how should I live my life if I believe the apostles? So this took over his life for him, and he decided to kind of emulate the great Christian writers that he had seen in the past in ways of talking to his culture about his faith.
Well, he had a fascinating life. It ended far too young. Prostate cancer got him at the age of 73. I recall at the end of his life, he lasted one day as a member of the LSU Board of Supervisors and then resigned because John McKithen told him that it was a waste of his time. And I see they both had the birth date of May 28th. Walker Percy would be 102 years on Monday.
Yeah.
John McKithen, 100 years. We've got a minute or so to go. James Fox Smith from Country Roads from St. Francisville is on the line. James, you're on with Jessica.
Jim, good morning. Thank you for taking the call. Jessica, it's lovely to speak to you. How are you?
It's good to hear your voice.
Likewise to you. I feel very triangulated talking with you through this medium, but we're so looking forward to welcoming you back to St. Francisville next weekend for the 5th annual Walker Percy Weekend, where you're going to be appearing, and this is your third visit to the festival, isn't that right?
Right. I cannot wait to be there. It's one of my favorite times of the year.
Well, it is next weekend, and you write about going to the Walker Percy Festival in St. Francisville in 2014. That's how you start your book.
Absolutely. I was attending, and the editor at LSU Press, Margaret Lovecraft, said, this audience is craving a book that helps them understand Walker Percy's novels better. And so we decided then and there to kind of create one, and now it's been a five-year project, and it's coming out this May.
And it is in my hand right now, reading Walker Percy's novels, Jessica Houghton Wilson, who will be in St. Francisville next weekend for the Walker Percy Festival. Congratulations, Jessica, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Have a good one. Today also marks the death of the great novelist Philip Roth. He was 85 years old. born in Newark, New Jersey in 1933, same birth year as Gus Weill and Ernest Gaines, Philip Roth, best known for Portnoy's Complaint. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.